Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Sophie McManus. Her book, The Unfortunates, was published on June 2nd, 2015. I guess that's this year. Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, one of the best publishing houses in the world for a long time. Sophie is a graduate of Vassar, Sarah Lawrence, the Master of Fine Arts program. Her work has appeared in American Short Fiction and Tin House. She lives in New York, and The Unfortunates is her first novel. The Unfortunates is a book about wealth, its advantages and disadvantages, how it moves the world, people, and their lives. Three characters create a perimeter around this concept, and each of the three, we see different aspects of what money is able to do. And as my dad would say, money changes everything. I feel, just as with water, that wealth can be serene, beautiful, and seemingly gentle. But when a storm or a tsunami or a wall of water comes about, the force of it is literally unstoppable. For all of mankind's intercourse, and it is somewhat sexual in a way, with money, barter, and wealth, most of us realize on some level or another that money, whatever it really is today, and I think it's information, is an unstoppable force, one that goes hand in hand with power. And as we are so wont to forget, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, viz. Donald Trump. Sophie has harnessed these concepts, or my believed concepts, in this, her first novel, and has done so in a fashion as to allow us easy access to a world that without this work, we might not be able. So welcome, Sophie, and thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure. That water analogy was beautiful and terrifying.
Well, it is. You know, when you watch the videos of things, you say, oh, I could stop that. I could run away from that. But you can't. You just think you could.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, well, let's go to the epigraph, which I like to start with a lot of times, because sometimes I think the author kind of means that to give the reader a guide to what the book is actually about, in which case yours is, "Behind every fortune, there is a great crime," by Balzac, who I think also said, "the oily wheels of fortune." So tell us a little, because it kind of frames the book, about the great crime that gave rise to the entire set of relationships that we encounter in The Unfortunates.
Sure. I realized only much later in the editing that there are a couple of crimes in the book, but maybe only two qualify as great and one is sort of minor. But the founding crime is how this family, who I based very, very loosely on the Vanderbilts and the Astors, how they collected their great fortune a couple generations before. And in their case, it was in the rubber trade, first in tapping the trees in the Amazon for rubber, and then later in World War II in the development of synthetic rubber, which was sort of a mashup of research I did and then things I made up for the convenience of the book.
Well, then the next question would, well, in my illogical mind, the illogical would be, and this is getting to telling the story of the book, which is the reason we're here, so you can sell copies of it. And I have an independent bookstore, and it will be on the front table, and we'll probably end up doing. In fact, someone came in this morning and said, "Aren't you going to do a book club about this?" And
oh, I said, that's wonderful.
I said, "Yeah, this is definitely a book club book."
Oh, good.
And maybe you could Skype in, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so if you come at the book from a certain angle about wealth and formation and the crime, tell us about the triad that forms the structure between the three protagonists of the book. You have Cece, the mother. You have George, her son, and Iris, who I love, her daughter-in-law. So those are the three main characters. There's tons of great peripheral characters we can get into.
Sure.
But tell us about the triad that forms those three.
I will, but, you know, it just occurred to me I didn't even reference the actual crime in the Amazon in my last answer. I forgot. so maybe I'll finish that first, which is when the United States began to develop synthetic latex and rubber, which was a response to feeling very nervous about producing something they needed so greatly in countries that were subtropic, that were not on U.S. territory. All the rubber mining operations in the Amazon were abandoned, and a really debated and huge number of miners were just left in the jungle to die.
Yeah, that's true, and it slipped my mind kind of. But then I think back to last week in the Republican debates, and a lot of those issues seem to me to come up throughout the questions that were asked in that debate. But be that as it may, so back to the three characters.
Yes, yes. So yes, we have these three characters who we alternate fairly regularly between their perspectives. And Cecilia Sumner is the family matriarch. She's in her mid-70s, and she's a real battle axe. She's difficult and impolitic and fairly powerful person in her universe. And she's diagnosed with a neurological disease that she feels may take her life soon, and so she enters a drug trial to try to slow or halt the progress of her illness. And then there's her son George, who's in his 40s, and he's a kind of classic rich ne'er-do-well. He's never really been asked to figure out who he is or do anything or be anything, and as a result, he's floundering and egomaniacal and somewhat grandiose and unstable, and more so as the book goes on. And then he has this new wife, Iris, who is from a working class background and is really trying to figure out the sort of ways and rules of this strange family and this strange culture that she's found herself in.
The interesting thing is, with that litany of flaws for each of them, I didn't really consider any of those characters bad people. Even Cece and George, you know, like especially at the beginning, and you really do a good job of it, where they're in the little dinghy going out to the boat for the party, and they're joking with each other, and they're really funny. And, you know, it's like they have this sense of humor between them that reappears throughout the book. And I figure as long as you have a sense of humor, you can't be the worst person in the world, you know?
You know, I feel the same way, but there is a really wide-ranging response. I've heard from some readers who really find you know, Cece or George to be, you know, monstrous. Someone told me that Cece was the most controlling mother figure she'd read in years, and I said, "Oh, really? I had no idea." You know, so I love them even as I did not respect them as I wrote them. Although that changed back and forth depending on where we were in the book.
There's this book, very few people have heard of it, it's by H.G. Wells, and it's called The Bulpington of Blup.
I've not heard of that, that's amazing.
You got to read it because it is George. And it's about this guy, and I think we all have this happen, is that you have a choice early on to go one way or another, like, you know, two roads diverged in a wood, and you take the wrong choice. And you get these opportunities throughout your life, and George has many of them throughout the book, where you could decide, you know what? And it's not hard, it's easy. You just have to decide you're gonna do it. I could make the right decision. And through whatever it is, whether it's laziness or genetic or nurturing, you don't do it. And then you find at the end of your life that you have essentially lived a life that wasn't yours at all.
Yeah, I think there's a good bit in this book about trying not to lead a life that you would look back on and regret. I think both George and Cece are not people who are totally aware of the world around them and sympathetic to the world around them, and they can't quite catch hold of some kind of meaningful connection in the way that other people might.
Well, and then that's the other thing is Iris, like I said, you know, I'm a guy, she's beautiful, she's well-meaning, she's bewildered because she's thrown into a situation that's totally foreign to her, but she's a loving person. She's a happy person. She's a humorous person. She feels sorry when she makes dreadful mistakes, not of her own making. She's such a very good person, don't you think?
I do. I always felt she was a generous person who was a little bit over her head.
Yeah. And the one thing, when I'm not going to spoil it, the one error that she makes and has nothing to do with her, she does try her very best, although it kind of backfires, into making it right. And in a sacrificial way, which is what George would not ever do.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think she cares about her marriage, and she loves her husband, even though for her to have loved him at all at first took a fair amount of blindness and naivete on her part, I think. But her impulses are genuine and true. They're just deposited with the wrong people in a way.
And again, without spoiling anything, that's true throughout the entire vein of the book, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. It really is.
Yeah. So it's funny. I guess I'm too generous sometimes in character. You know, you've developed these so well that you feel like you know them. The kind of people that, you know, I'll remember their names, if not for the rest of my life, I'll remember them for a long time. Like, the only truly, really bad guy is Bob. And even he has a certain saving quality at the end, don't you think?
I do. I don't know. I laughed every time I wrote him. I had a great time writing that character.
I bet.
He's so, I mean, he's awful, but he's totally frank and forward and honest in his awfulness. He's, you know, whatever awful thing he wants, you know it because he's asked for it, usually in the most obscene way possible. And so he's very much unlike these characters who are like Cece, who is so locked up and careful about how she conducts herself and interacts with the world, that I think maybe, especially for me, because if I'd been writing in Cece's voice for, you know, a few days, it was great to get away to Bob, you know?
Yeah, the funny thing about Bob is when I practiced law, I had this case with this guy who ran for lieutenant governor of Florida, or governor, actually. And so during the case, which was a fairly big one, whenever anything good would happen, he would take credit for it, and he'd be in the paper. And then when everything bad happened, he would blame it on me, and it would be in the paper. And I said to him,
convenient.
I know, and I said, Rod, oh, now he knows who it is. I said, Rod, how can you know I did that? Why would you? He goes, Sam, I'm a politician. That's what I do.
Yeah.
And that's how, yeah, Bob is.
It's absolutely true. You know, there's something I read about really late. I think I'd written most of the book, but I wish I'd read about it earlier, called the just world hypothesis, which is it's a really depressing thing, which is when they study people at various economic levels and income levels, they see that the wealthier people are, the more they believe the world to be just, which is to say they are where they are because of their merit and their hard work. And then anyone who is less fortunate is where they are, perhaps because they somehow did not do it right. And so there's no accounting for, you know, things like racism or discrimination or bad luck or ill health. Or that's an unfortunate, the graph goes the wrong way in terms of pairing empathy with privilege.
Yeah, and that's also brought out well in the book, because you have a character, Esme, who is like the admirable Crichton. She takes care of so much. She's unappreciated. She takes care of so much, and she has this love that she gives to people who are not necessarily deserving of that love, but she does so. And Audrey, George's assistant, is the same, even to the end, to the bad spot. She is there for him, not necessarily in a really active way at the end, but she's still there for them. And they aren't rich people at all.
It's true, and she gets rewarded well enough, I think, in the book.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah, I was an administrative assistant in many different places in my 20s, and I just felt like all of Audrey's kind of evasive and slightly less enthusiastic than they could have been responses were just like it was like the compilation of the greatest hits of all my mediocre assistanting over the years.
Well, you know what's bad is when you have a job where you want to do a lot, but the person you work for isn't doing anything.
Yes. Yeah, it's awkward.
It's awkward, and it makes you feel bad. You want to wake up in the morning raring to go and having your list or having 10 tapes that you have to transcribe or something like that, and that wasn't the way it was.
Yeah. I think that's true for a lot of people, especially starting out in like entry-level jobs.
Yeah. That's kind of what happens in a way with, you know, Bob, like you said, is out there. He doesn't make any bones about who he is, what he did, who he has amorous intentions towards. And so I'm pretty good at not spoiling it, right?
You're doing a great job. It's a very convoluted plot, and you're skating very gracefully along.
Well, so like George's encounter when he, you know, says, hey, Bob, Bob says, hey, George, come over here. And there's the guys, two women, whatever. And then subsequently George does something he shouldn't do. It's like he just can't. That's what I'm talking about, choices. He can't just say no. And the other side of that coin is, and the megalomania portion of it is that he gets caught up in a mentally ill, unstable fashion with his pet project. And it's horrible. And I don't know where I'm going with this because I can't do it without spoiling it. But when Cece's in the home and she listens to it, you can add if you want. But when she listens, go ahead, tell me. You tell me instead of me talking all the time.
I think it's safe to say that George decides to write an opera, and it's a really offensive, ridiculous, dystopian vision of the world sort of post-environmental apocalypse that, you know, it's totally meritless as a piece of music, but it's also, it sort of reveals fairly gross ideas he has about human beings as well.
Yeah, and it's so funny because even the sidelight, who he gets to, and you know, like when Iris goes, you have no backers? And he just has these people that glom onto him for no reason other than they can make money. And the thing is, that was what's so funny. It was absolutely horrible. So horrible. Yeah. It was almost so bad that it was good, you know? And I think that was really well handled too. But it came from a good place. He loved music. And
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, you're right.
It's I don't know. It's what's scary about the book for me is that sometimes I see George and myself. Sometimes I see Iris, and sometimes in a certain way I see Cece. Did you find yourself? I know I read your reviews, your interviews about autobiography and things like that. Did you ever see these characters in yourself or others?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I don't. So I don't write very autobiographically in the sense of, you just change the name of the person who you want to write about. I've never written places I knew or people I knew, but. But yeah, all of these characters, I think, at certain points represented things about myself that I didn't like or had questions about. And then as you're writing, they change and they become more complicated and they become their own creatures. But in George's case, you know, I feel like that opera really represented the writer's fear of exposure, that you think you're doing something that might be good or might be great and is in fact terrible, and might, you know, reveal to yourself and to the world that your project is a waste of time and you have been mistaken and what you share with the world is only your own sort of egotistical fantasy about yourself. I think every writer fears that at the outset a little bit, and so this is just a kind of hyper ridiculous version of that fear in a way.
You know, I was talking about peripheral characters too, like in the opera. But you have, and then, you know, when you're reading, you think the plot's going to be somewhat straightforward. You think you can kind of see what's going on, but then the peripheral characters, especially say Bill, become a big part of the story. Victor, her Iris's friend and helper, and then Bill, Victor's partner. But then on top of everything else, you have this dog, 3D. And it's surprising how much space he takes up in the plot, and kind of in a nice way, right?
Yeah, I realized in writing that, whereas Victor, I mean, Iris only has really one friend who is Victor, but then in a way she really only has one true friend, which is her dog. She's quite alone in this world. So he takes up a lot of space because he's in some ways more important to her in her day-to-day than her husband is.
It's funny about Victor, too, because I really, really, really expected it to go a certain way, and it didn't. I didn't even know.
I wish you could tell me, but I think you can't tell me. That's what I'm guessing.
Yes, that's what you're guessing. I expected it to go that way and it to be, and George discovers and all that stuff. But which he kind of did suspect. But anyway, okay, sorry. all right, here's where I'm going to be really treading on thin ice with you, and you might get mad at me. So I mean, with you, Nightingale, Bramford, Vassar, Sarah Lawrence, your father's president of Time Warner, your house is on the Upper West Side. Your marriage is in the New York Times, for God's sakes. You leave school from time to time to go to Elaine's. Where do you differ? Why are you riding the subway? What I mean, because you have a lot. You could be in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. I think. I have a very weird sort of childhood history with the idea of wealth and money, and that when I was young, my family was middle class. My dad was a journalist, and my mom, when they met, was actually his assistant. And then my dad had this career that looks exactly like the myth of the American dream that is usually almost always a myth, right? Like, he just kept getting better and better jobs, and he was a company man. He was at the same place for, I don't know, 35 years. He started out hanging billboards for Sports Illustrated in the late 50s. So I was a kid at a very fancy school, but not a fancy kid. And then much later on, when I went to college, was really when the kind of privilege piece for my family fell to us. So I was sort of in and out of that world simultaneously, and that's probably why I noticed its contours more than I would have if it had been all one thing or all the other.
It's funny how wealth presents itself to people depending on their upbringing and depending on a lot of things. Like, in my family, I have two brothers, and, you know, we do well, but we don't have a plane, we don't have boats, we don't have jewelry, we don't have fancy cars. And if I came into the office wearing a gold necklace, even if I wanted one, my brothers would just laugh at me so hard that I'd have to take it off. And it's like, it's not the material stuff that is ever, the only thing that wealth, I think, has done for me in my life has been allowed me to travel. And I think everything else is pretty much first world problems. And actually, and your book, in some senses, revolves around this. When I was younger, and people would say to me, as long as you have your health, I had no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah, sure.
None. And then I realized you could have as much money as Croesus, and it wouldn't make any difference at all once you don't have your health, right?
Yeah, I think that's one reason that I was interested in writing a character who was this wealthy dealing with illness, because it is indeed the one place where control cannot really be exerted. I mean, the body is not ours to do with forever, you know. So that's really how that plot line developed.
And that's why it's also very interesting how when Cece goes to the institution where she is searching for and may very well find an answer to her mortality question, that she meets this other person who becomes her friend. And at times she's confused about why that person is her friend. And she has to wrestle with that in her mind. And I felt that was a lot of the stuff where she was very telling about her, and telling about her in the sense of her being a good person deep down.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the only ways we learn about life and about ourselves is by being exposed to new people and new things, as obvious as that sounds. But for someone like Cece, her life was so contained by her wealth and well controlled. I think the climat of whatever was happening to her was always by her design. That you know, Dottie, her friend, when she's at this at Oak Park, in some ways it's like her first camp friend, even though she's 75. You know, you have to, you take it where you can get it. You know.
Yeah, and Dottie is one of those people that's just not necessarily. She's not necessarily happy. What is she? What is she that makes her, in some ways, diametrically opposed to Cece? That, what is it? It's not really acceptance either. What was it?
I don't know if she's happy, but she's certainly content, and I think she's in a truly loving marriage, which is something that Cece has never known, and one of the reasons she is so difficult. And I think she also is very certain about God and the afterlife, which is very comforting. So Dottie does not have any of the troubles that Cece has with looking at illness.
So speaking of wealth, I was in the Hamptons this weekend. And I met this woman who was 95, and she was a wonderful, wonderful, beautiful woman. And she said all she wanted to do between now and whenever she goes is to figure out in her own mind if there's something after, if she can find something. And she wasn't saying there was or there wasn't, but she just wanted to be able to find something that she could hold on to that would give her some presentment that there might be a continuation of either her existence or something that was after. And that's
how is she going about that? Did she tell you? That's a big project.
No, she was asking me. she was asking anybody who would listen to her question. Of course, I told my mother, who's 92 and is going to outlive me, and my mother's Jewish, and my mother says, tell her to go to a Catholic church.
That's great.
Which my mother will do. I go to St. Pat's every time I'm in New York, and I sit down. But you know, it's funny because she does. In some ways, this is getting towards the end, so I can't really say it. But in some ways, no, I'm not going to do it. Okay, I'll switch something to something else. So in tell about this is not a spoiler at all because they've excerpted it in almost all the reviews. Talk about, you can explain Cece a little bit this way. When she has her little boat shoes that have to have white bottoms, even though other people won't know that. Tell about the lecture she gives to the staff. Set that up and tell the lecture.
Sure. I was so delighted to discover the rule of white bottom shoes on a boat, which I had not known. I somehow Googled my way to that. And I also read a couple handbooks for servants. Of wealthy people, sort of about the etiquette and code of these, you know, ridiculous 1% scenarios, like being on the boat. So in the very beginning of the boat, we really meet Cece by way of an indulgently long monologue I wrote, where she is she's telling the catering staff how to behave, and she's got, I think, maybe, you know, 20 points that she feels very severe about. And the, you know, the staff stands and twitches and accepts her her tirade. There's a lot of food in that section. She talks about the food a lot in a way that's very visceral that I don't think I could write now because I was a waiter when I wrote that, and I was serving very fancy oysters every night and you know, a variety of plates with raw fish and. So that's sort of where that came from.
And I like the fact that while she's doing it, she's giving both backhanded compliments and thinly veiled insults. Like when she says, and you know, the way that you put the fruit there in the area where it will get the most sun, as opposed to primarily keeping it in the shade. Those kinds of things, she's like, if she's an expert at anything, she's an expert at that.
Yes, and she's also an expert at giving very, very faint praise or very sort of elliptically sort of unpleasant insults that I think sometimes other characters don't quite even realize how rude she's being until they skip a beat and then they understand.
Well, the humor is like when George is rowing her out and she says, this old tub is leaking, and if we go to the bottom, you know what they're going to say, don't you?
It's true. She's not the gentlest of mothers, I don't think.
But it is really funny.
I think they all have their humor. That might just be a function of how long it took me to write the book, I think. characters that didn't have a sense of humor I couldn't have lived with for, the 10-ish years that I wrote it.
I know, I always am amazed when authors say it took 10 years. I mean, obviously it didn't take 10 years, but it took 10 years to complete during the time that you were writing. And it seems your life, especially since you're so young, your life must have changed so much during that time that your viewpoints either evolved or you erased your characters and redrew them or something like that?
I think all of the above. I suspect the early drafts of this book look like an entirely different book, and I shudder at just even the idea of like trying to find them and look at them, but I think it changed quite dramatically, yeah.
How come, because this is my brother and my favorite book, how come you love Confederacy of Dunces so much?
Oh, isn't that a great book?
A wonderful book.
I don't know. I think somehow the, it is about love. I think somehow the amount of love one feels for Ignatius while reading that book is so, it's just so total, even as he's being, flatulent and difficult and shrill, and he's got his yellow pads that he's scribbling on. I'm not sure how the author did that, but it stays with you for forever, I think.
And just the fact that he died, killed himself, and then his mother shops the book around for 10 years till she finds Walker Percy. I mean, otherwise it wouldn't be there.
It's amazing, that story.
But whenever,
and how generous of her. You know, there's this mother character who is certainly not sympathetic, you know. And for her to not bridle at that in any way and see the merit of the book, it's really neat.
When my brother and I go to some kind of dinner or function and we eat too much, we always say, I think my valve is closing.
And no one knows what you're saying.
No one has any idea. We have a lot of those, but and it takes people aback and makes them think we're weird, which we are, but
there you go, you're bookish, you know.
Yeah. But it's funny because, you know, it kind of runs against some of the things you've been saying, but you just said it. You said you love him, and he's a complete jackass. I mean, he couldn't be, and what's his, well, I forgot what his girlfriend's name is, his platonic girlfriend. Yeah. But, you know, he says horrible things to her and does things with the hot dog cart that he shouldn't be doing. But yes, you love him, though. But why do you love him? Do you love Cece?
I mean, I love Cece endlessly, or I certainly did while I was writing her. I mean, I think books that where we love someone we wouldn't love in real life, or it's not the only way to get to the deepest function of novels and story writing. But I think one of the deepest functions is to really, it's this twin thing. Like on the one hand, when you read a book, you are the only person seeing that image that way. It affirms your totally unique imagination, right? Like you are completely alone when you read a book, both literally and in terms of your mind is nothing like the mind of any other person, you know, in the history of the world. But then at the same time, I think we're also connected to people who we would not be connected to at a really deep, you know, way where we're paired, you know, down to the things like fear of death and love and, you know, desire and so then we're connected to other people in a really profound way as we're being connected only to ourselves when we read. I mean, for me, that's like the big awesome thing that only narrative art does, you know?
Yeah, and it's like with the my bookstore. It's like the people who come in, thank God, because otherwise I wouldn't have a bookstore, who say they love to hold a real book. They love to have, like, the author in their hands. And they certainly could read it on their iPad or Kindle, and you can look up the word in the dictionary by pressing it. But there's just something about, they have this, I don't know what it is. They have this formulaic idea that if they're reading the real book, then the real author is there with them somehow.
Yeah, there's also like a sense of like private communion with both the book and the author when you're, you know, squirreled away wherever you want to be in your house or whatever reading. I think you don't have that even if you like don't have the internet on your, you know, whatever your device is. You're still somehow like connected to, you know, now like the increasing amount of like data collecting that's going on while you're reading, and the possibility of checking your email or flipping to another book or whatever.
I think what it is that people don't like the idea of a digital world. They like the idea of an analog world. And I know your next book is going to deal with technology, right?
Yeah, I think so. Right now it's a jellyfish, you know? It's like glowing and mushy, and I don't know where it's going. But that certainly is something that I think about a lot. So it'll be in there one way or another.
That's why I was saying at the beginning that I think wealth is turning into something different. It's information. The faster you can move information around, that extra speed you have is what creates wealth now. It's not dollars or petrodollars. Just my opinion.
Yeah. But also might create a good deal of chaos.
Yeah.
As the speed ramps up, too.
Yeah, and who knows what's going to happen when on the internet a year occurs in a day. It's, you know, you're young, I'm old, and, you know, I thought I was always going to be on the crest of this technology. I thought, you know, Sam, you're going to always be ahead of the curve, and I fell behind it, and now there's just no way I can catch up to my 14-year-old. She has to.
I think their brains are really working a little bit differently from ours.
Yeah.
In terms of how they interact with it. It's quite amazing.
For good or for bad. I mean, look at texting. There's a study I read that says that kids can no longer recognize facial expressions in other people because they don't deal with other people face-to-face. So they don't recognize sarcasm or longing or sadness. They don't see those. I guess we're self-evolving, but I guess that's what's happening.
That doesn't sound good. That sounds all bad to me.
You're funny. I like your answers. Your answers, like some authors will go on and on and on. You just answer the question and then you stop.
And then I stop. I should probably learn going on and on. I think that's part of the media training that I never...
It probably is.
...myself to.
But this is so much more refreshing.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
So other people, you intimated that other people have different views of your characters. Do you find that exciting? Do you find that unnerving? Did you expect everyone to feel the same way?
I think you know, the really honest and totally shallow answer is that if they like the book, then I don't care. They could do whatever they want with it, you know, and that's part of how the reader, you know, the reader really does get to do whatever they want with every single book they read. It'll, you know, different things mean different things to various readers, and that's great, you know. Once you publish a book, I think it doesn't belong to you anymore. But if someone has you know, totally misread the character and really doesn't like them, then I feel a little blue. But you know, you can't get everybody.
And the next question I was going to ask you was, you know, your book no longer belongs to you. Do you have a sense of loss? Do you mind letting go of it completely and letting, you know, your firstborn, it is your firstborn. I don't know if that's literally or figuratively, but close.
I hope figuratively.
No, it's definitely figuratively. My bad.
Yeah, okay.
My bad. Sorry. So do you feel like that your little baby is out in the world and has to grow up on its own?
Yeah, now it's good. Now I'm fine. But I certainly felt like during the production process, you know, where the publisher is actually turning the book into a physical thing with a cover and a typeface and that I really felt like they were slowly and kindly and gently just wresting the thing from me, just dragging it out of my hands because I had been writing it for so long. I didn't want to leave the space of the book, you know, that my head had occupied for so long. So I was certainly like a moody author, although I think I never I never showed them that, I hope, but I had this sense that I was like locking myself out of my own house by giving them the book, you know. And then I was meant to like stand by the window of the house for the next year and point inside and say, like, everybody go look in that house. Like, I can't go in, but you can. But now I'm on to the next, and I can just look at it fondly.
That was a really good answer.
Because
I asked that question to everybody, and they never answer it that way. So what about, so the cover is really good, and I say this every show because I have a bookstore. So everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes into my bookstore judges every book by its cover.
Of course.
Yeah, and it's a great cover, but did you get a chance to vet it? Did you do it? Were there 10 of them they showed you?
I did. There were three covers before this, and they were really patient and great. About letting me vet. The first couple of covers I felt like were really close to chick lit and really close to commercial fiction in a way that I worried if someone bought the book with those covers and then like got on the airplane like 2 hours into their flight, they'd be so mad that they'd been misled. And of course, on the other hand, then the people who would like the book wouldn't buy it because they would be put off. So I was really happy when this cover came along. It seems like kind of the perfect, you know, it's inviting, but it's a little bit mean. It's not really the right word, but there's some sort of edge to it that I feel like represents the book pretty well.
Yeah, I guess the publishers are pretty smart, and they want to sell books, so the covers they pick, I think it's kind of good they let the authors not in it completely. It's like if you're a chef and you own a restaurant, you don't want to really manage the restaurant or open another one because you can't be a chef in that restaurant.
Yeah, it's true.
And so I think another cool thing about this, it's not something you can say, ooh, this is the beach read for 2015, or like you said, chick lit kind of thing. I think it's something that, you know, well, as a man, yeah, that I can find accessible in terms of, yeah, I wouldn't mind reading this and have someone see me reading this with this cover, you know? It makes a big difference.
Yeah, that was actually an exact email that I sent to my my beleaguered editor. I said, with the first cover I saw, I said, I can't imagine a man standing on the subway holding this cover, yeah, as beautiful as it is. And that actually became my litmus test.
Yeah. It's a good one. And the thing about like that lady coming in this morning and picking up the book and looking at it and says, can we do this as our next book club? And it has that kind of cover too, but that'll have to be till it comes out in paperback because no one in the book club will spring for a hardback, unfortunately.
I know.
But except we give them a really good discount, so sometimes they will. But and there won't be any men in it because there's never men in any book clubs.
It's true. They have other ways of bonding. They circle around other things, I think. But it would be great if they had book clubs.
Well, I'm starting a nonfictional one, and the first one is going to be Eric Larson's Dead Wake. About the Lusitania, so we'll see if I can get any guys to show up at that one.
You'll just have to see who shows up.
Yeah, it'll be me. Me and one guy, Warren.
Your brother, too, maybe?
No, my brothers won't even come anywhere near me, generally, unless it's absolutely necessary.
So they're not there.
Yeah, now we're giving more spoilers on my side. The thing about what I was going to say about the book club is, this is the kind of book that there will be people like, leaning across the table trying to choke the other person because they say George has redeeming qualities. And those are good book club books. Because don't you think that, I mean, you and I are talking about it a little bit, but don't you think that people are going to do that with this book? Or have they already done it in your talks?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I've like Skyped into a couple of book clubs and they do seem very animated and not always of the same mind, which is really nice. I think if you're in a sort of book club that actually talks about books, that's great. But if you're in a book club that, you know, the books are sort of the occasion to not talk about books, then maybe this is not the book for that book club. But yeah, absolutely. I think it's a fertile book for conversation, which I'm really delighted that seems to be the case.
It's funny because, you know, doing this week in and week out. you know, you say, okay, this is a certain type of book, this is a certain type of book, and I need every once in a while to get like a reality check. So I reread Crime and Punishment last week, and I realized the same thing is true of Raskolnikov. You could have a book club where people would say, oh, what a good person, too bad he did this, or what a terrible person, I can't believe that Dostoevsky is giving him a chance to be redeemed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think all the great characters are so complex that you know, we can argue about the merit of what they do or the motive for what they do. Those are the good ones.
Well, it's been great talking to you. I have other questions, but now we've been talking close to, well, 50 minutes. Yeah, 50 minutes.
Oh my God, that blew by.
I know, it really did. So anyway, yeah, I'm looking forward to the next book, and when this comes out in paperback, maybe, or if we do the book club in hardback, maybe you can Skype in or we can do something like that.
I will happily come to Philadelphia for a book club with you guys. Are you kidding?
Oh, if you come to Philadelphia, then, like, we're having this, I forgot her first name, Skylar, who did the Book of Speculation, and then we had Christina Baker Klein, and we couldn't have it in the bookstore because there were so many people responding.
Oh, that's amazing. That's great.
Yeah, so if you're in the Philadelphia area or if you get to speak at the free library or something like that, yeah, we'll get a car and drive you out and we'll have dinner and all kinds of stuff. It'll be good.
I would love to. That would be awesome.
Okay, I can't wait to talk to you again.
Great. Thank you so much.
That was Sophie McManus. And once again, I made a new friend, which is so important to me on these shows. She wrote The Unfortunates. It was published June 2nd. It's a great book. It's a great study in wealth and high society. I mean, it's like the Hamptons. It's like the Vanderbilts. It's like the people that, and it's very much like the wealth that's being represented in the presidential races as we move forward with the Koch brothers and Koch brothers and Trump and all the money that's being raised. It's very much dealing with that and how wealth changes lives. And you know, for the worst most of the time, the happiest people in the world in all these surveys are people who live in Ethiopia or people who live in Bosnia, and it's they're happy because they find happiness in the moment. They're happy because they fed their children. They're not happy because they just bought a $257,000 Lamborghini. Although that makes people happy, they just don't know what happiness is supposed to be. It's a substitute for happiness that allows them to live the rest of their life thinking they're something when they're actually something different. Enough of that. Anyway, so as I always say, join us every week. I'm trying to look. Oh, yeah, so we have a bunch of things coming up. The Bees, which was, we interviewed Lillian and Paul before the book was popular at all. Now it's up for the Orange Prize. But what used to be the Orange Prize is now called the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. So that we're going to rerun that because it was such a good book. And I'm so glad I got it early on, like Rebecca got us Gone Girl before Gillian Flynn's name was even known. Annie Jacobson's going to be on the show. She wrote The Pentagon's Brain, which is nonfiction, which is great for me, An Uncensored History of DARPA, which is America's top secret military research agency. And there's a whole bunch of other ones we got lined up, taking us into almost now late autumn. So I'm really looking forward to being able to talk to those people. I've read a couple of the upcoming books. And like I said, I go back every once in a while and read something like Kafka or Tolstoy to get an idea of the quality of what I'm interviewing now. And I find it to be perfectly akin. And so in any event, thank you so much for listening to this broadcast, Sophie McManus, The Unfortunates. It's a great book. I love talking to her. And as usual, I love the fact that you allow me the opportunity to do so. So join us next week again on The Avid Reader, and we'll talk again at that time.